So if we follow the normal schedule for the semester, there are three more lectures, well, you know, three more weeks into our semester. So, you know, lectures in the morning, lectures in the afternoon. So next week on March 26th and April 2nd, and that would be the official end of the semester, but we missed out a week. So my intention is to add, make up for that lecture on the following week. So we have three more weeks to go. And therefore, you know, including, well, three more, you know, six more lectures, excluding the one this afternoon. I'm not sure whether I'll be able to finish up everything that I wanted to finish up in those 3 weeks. Namely, I'm not sure if I'll have enough time to talk about black holes. So what might happen, but I don't know, as of yet, is I might schedule maybe one or two additional lectures on some later day for those of you who feel that you want more for your money and would like to get a little bit more material, if I don't get to a point where I feel that that it's enough. The other thing to deal with is also the presentations. And my intention here would be to try to find a day where all of us could get together and have a day at it, you know, start in the morning, break for lunch, and continue in the afternoon, where each of you could give, you know, a 20-minute or so presentation on their term paper. And I was thinking that while I won't be able to do it next week because I'll be traveling, I was thinking that the presentations, it doesn't have to be on a Wednesday, but, you know, let me throw this out as a possibility. It could be on April 23rd, which would be not the Wednesday following this one, but it would be the one after that. And, of course, I'd have to, you know, check the schedule with people here to make sure we can book a room that day, that it doesn't conflict with a conference or something like that. And, of course, all of you would have to be here as well, so you have something about when we actually do this. So does anybody have an obvious conflict with that date? But anyway, we don't have to decide today, but let's, you know, let's perhaps choose this as our default date. Maybe by next week you could have a careful look at your schedule and, you know, and make sure that there's no conflict. And if we're okay with that next week, then I'll go and try to book, you know, book the facilities for that day. And you know, that will be then the, you know, the final, you know, the final day with all the presentations, and it should be pretty interesting because all of you have such different topics. We're going to learn about that day, I think. So that would be my intention. So and then there might be you know, a couple of extra ones, extra lectures, you know, that probably would have to follow after that week or even during that week, depending on how we feel about where I managed to go with the lectures. Okay, so any questions? And my expectation then is that you'll be, you know, you'll be prepared on that day to give your presentation, and at the same time you'll be handing in your term paper. So that gives you, you know, an idea for the deadline for writing up the term paper. Okay, so having said that, let's go back to what we were talking about. So I'll redraw the picture that that I had before. So here's the finite dimensional, the finite region of space-time in which we're working, bounded by a surface sigma 1, a surface sigma 2, foliated by a bunch of surfaces sigma t, with boundaries st, and then we have this, you know, the rim of the whirl tube here, which I've denoted b, and then we have this breakdown of the boundary of v, v being the interior of that tube. The boundary of this being broken down into a surface sigma 2 and a surface sigma 1 with a minus sign to remind us that the normals point differently depending on whether you're looking at the future directed normal relative to the outward normal, which would be pointing backwards. And then, of course, there's B itself, which is part of the boundary. And the last thing that I did this morning was to write down an expression for the gravitational action, going back to something we did before, in terms of in terms of the four-dimensional Ricci scalar integrated over V. And then we had all the surface terms involving, you know, their own extrinsic curvature and their own volume elements. So we had this one. We had another one for sigma 1 with the opposite sign. And then we had one for B involving its extrinsic curvature, which is that curly K symbol that I have trouble with, integrated over over B. And then I had this expression for the four-dimensional Ricci scalar in terms of the three-dimensional Ricci scalar on sigma t plus terms quadratic in the extrinsic curvature and plus the rest of it, which involves this pure divergence involving the normal vector on each surface sigma t. And as I told you, what we're going to be doing here is to push the volume integral of the pure divergence, use Gauss's theorem to push that on the boundary, each piece of the boundary. And then we're going to see that there's going to be some interesting cancellations taking place. This term will go away. This term will go away. And there'll be an extra contribution to that term. So I'll go through the details of that. OK. So let's look. So what I want to do is to look at the volume integral of all this, which means that I'm going to be looking at everywhere on delta V. So there's an extra minus sign, and there's an extra factor of 2. So I'm really looking at this. Integrated over the entire boundary, which needs to be broken down into a piece involving sigma 2, a piece involving sigma 1, and a piece involving B. And what I need to do in order to evaluate this is for each piece of the boundary, I need to work out the surface element in terms of, you know, the normal vector and the three-dimensional volume element and all of that stuff. I need to make sure that I handle the signs correctly. And what we'll do is to relate those derivatives here to things like the extrinsic curvature and things like that. So we just need to work this out. And we'll see how it goes. So suppose that I focus on the piece of the boundary, which is sigma 2. The volume element on sigma 2, and here we have to go back to what we did in chapter 3, you know, all of that discussion we had on volume elements. What we discovered there is that the surface element is going to be directed in the direction of the normal vector, and it's going to involve the three-dimensional volume element on the hypersurface. But one little twist that we have to remember is the fact that there was a factor of epsilon in the relationship between the surface element and what it stands for in terms of the normal vector and the three-dimensional volume element. And we have to, you know, carefully account for that minus sign. If we didn't, of course, we'd make a mistake. So this minus sign is important. And, you know, if you trace back you know, its origin, it has to do with the fact that, well, we define this in a certain way. And the relationship between this and that involved that factor of epsilon, which changes sign depending on whether the normal is space-like or time-like. And here, because it's time-like, we have to incorporate a minus sign. Okay, so if we make the substitution then we're going to get minus, we get plus, we get an integral over sigma 2, and then we get everything else. And now we multiply this by the normal vector, and we get h, and we integrate. So now all I want to do is to work on this a little bit. I can just write down each term individually. And what I get first is n alpha differentiated with respect to beta in the direction of n beta. And then I have n multiplying n that produces a minus 1. And we get plus the divergence of n. And this is something that we integrate. Things simplify. That term is 0 because n alpha differentiated is the same thing as half the inner product of n with itself differentiated. So this is the same thing as a half n alpha differentiated. So that's a step that we've seen before. So because n alpha is defined as a unit vector, of course, n alpha is always minus 1, and its derivative is always 0, which means that we lose the first term. Well, the second term is, the divergence of the normal vector is what you get when you take the derivative of the vector and you multiply by the metric. If you go back to your notes from this morning, we have completeness relations that allow us to express the metric in terms of the normal direction and the tangential components. So this is something that can be written as minus n alpha n beta plus HAB e alpha A e beta B. So those are the completeness relations for the metric. By the same argument, we lose this piece of the equation. And then what we have here is something that we recognize as the gradient of the normal vector projected down to the hypersurface. That's the definition for the extrinsic curvature on the hypersurface. And what we have at this stage is HAB multiplying KAB. And that is precisely the trace of the extrinsic curvature. So what we get from this is the fact that the piece of this integral that belongs to sigma 2 becomes, after all this simplification, it becomes 2 sigma 2. And we have the integral of k over the hypersurfaces, over the hypersurface, V3y. And if I took care of the signs right, we have this that adds on to the previous term involving sigma 2. But you see that over there we have minus 2, here we have plus 2, and we have cancellation of those two terms. So that's what I was talking about, and it just follows from the calculation. So that's what happens for sigma 2. I don't think I'll redo it for sigma 1 because it's exactly the same thing except for an extra minus sign. And the bottom line is that by accounting for those two pieces on sigma 2 and sigma 1, we get rid of this term and we'll get rid of that term. The only thing that we now need to worry about is, well, the contribution from this surface integral on B. So we've lost this piece, we've lost that piece, but now we have to work carefully on the remaining piece. So let's do that. On B, well, now we have a different expression for the surface element. So now we don't have this extra minus sign because now the normal vector is space-like. And the normal vector to B, if you go back to your notes from this morning, we called it R alpha. And the volume element, the three-dimensional volume element on B involves the metric gamma, its determinant. And we're integrating over the z-coordinates. And later on, I'll choose those z-coordinates to be t and theta a the way that I did it this morning. All right. So on B, we have that. And we make the substitution into the piece of the surface integral that belongs to B. So now we have the minus sign and the factor of 2. We have an integral over B. And then we get the rest of it, n alpha semicolon beta n beta minus n alpha n beta. We've got that. We've got r alpha and the three-dimensional volume element. So again, we'll get some simplification from this. We should remember that n and r are orthogonal vectors. N was always pointing normal to the hypersurface, normal to each sigma t. R is normal to st, but it's normal but within sigma t. So it's the normal st that's still within the surface sigma t, the way that we constructed it. And therefore, n and r are orthogonal vectors. So we're going to use that and get rid of this term, which involves the inner product between the two vectors. And what we have in this case is minus 2, the integral of r alpha n differentiated in direction of n. I'm going to work on this a little bit. What I'm going to do is to transfer the derivatives. I'm going to use the fact that r dotted with n is actually 0. So I could differentiate the combination and compensate by just differentiating r. And what we would find is that, well, again, using the fact that r and n are orthogonal, what I find is that I can transfer the derivative from n to r at the price of introducing a minus sign. And that's what we get for B. So the final result for the B piece of the integral is plus 2, an integral over B. And here we have R alpha semicolon beta and alpha and beta. And I'm going to leave it as that for the time being. And what I'm going to do next is to, go back to the original expression for the gravitational action. I'm going to throw this inside the volume integral. This has already been dealt with as a surface term. I'm going to modify the surface term to add this contribution to that contribution. And we're going to have something that's closer to where we want to be for the final answer. So after making those substitutions, we'll end up with something like this. 16 pi, the gravitational action, is going to be an integral over V. But now I'm foliating V with my space-like surfaces. So what I'm really doing here is an integral between T1 and T2. And I'm breaking down my four-dimensional volume integral into an integral over time and then an integral over each hypersurface of constant time. This is how I'm going to write my four-dimensional volume integral. And we get all of the volume terms, which come, which we have over there. We have the three-dimensional Ricci scalar. We have KAB squared. And we have minus k squared. And the volume element, root g d4x, I'm going to write as the lattice quantity times the determinant of the induced metric on each hypersurface. And this is what I integrate over the hypersurfaces. So this is what I get from the volume terms after using the foliation of my four-dimensional domain into the three-dimensional hypersurfaces. So we have that, and then we have the remaining boundary terms that live on B. What we have is a factor of 2 in front of each And then we get an integral over B. And we get the script, you know, the curly k quantity, which is the extrinsic curvature. You know, I'll return to that in a moment. Plus what I got from over here. And that's what we're integrating over B using this volume element. So that's where we stand. And we'll need to work a little bit, we'll need to work a little bit on that to clean this up a little bit. And then what I'll do also in the next stage is to rewrite this in terms of the foliation of B into our ST surfaces. You know, rewrite this as a time integral and an angular integration over each one of the closed ST surfaces. And after that will be done, we'll have the expression for the gravitational action properly expressed and decomposed in the 3+1, you know, decomposition that, you know, is required if we're going to proceed from here and get to the Hamiltonian. Okay? So let's deal with the rest of it. So no big mysteries here. It's pretty straightforward. I think the hardest piece to get right in this calculation is to make sure that all the signs are handled properly, and that requires a little bit of thinking, but there's nothing very hard about this. Okay, let me work on that. So the extrinsic curvature that lives on B is a trace of, you know, the tensorial extrinsic curvature. And the tensorial extrinsic curvature is something that was defined in the usual way in terms of the derivative of the normal vector field on B projected down. The hypersurface. So that's the usual definition, and I wrote it down this morning. And what we can do here is to re-express this by using the completeness relations, because this is a piece of the metric on B, and the rest of it, well, is the full metric minus the normal direction. So that's, again, involving the completeness relation where I write down the inverse metric in terms of the radial components plus the tangential components and the normal components and the tangential components, which are found right here. And that's how I'm going to express k, and I'm going to combine it with the other piece inside the boundary integral. And we notice that, well, each piece has a factor involving the derivative of the normal vector. And those pieces will combine in a rather interesting way. So k, curly k, plus the other piece of the integrand, which is the normal component of this, well, becomes this combination here. And using, again, a set of completeness relations that we wrote down this morning, well, if you take the metric and you add to that the normal component in this direction, and you add to that or subtract from that the normal component in that direction, what you're left with is a two-dimensional metric on each surface ST. And if you go back to your notes this morning, you'll recognize this as sigma AB E alpha A E beta B. Because the full metric on ST can be decomposed into a normal component going in a time-like direction, a normal component going in, you know, the space-like direction. So that's the N component, the R component. And what's left are the purely tangential components on each surface ST. And that's the completeness relation that that we had this morning. And at this stage, well, what do we have? We have that we have the inverse two-dimensional metric on ST. And then we have a combination of terms which we recognize as the two-dimensional extrinsic curvature of ST embedded either in sigma t or embedded directly in the four-dimensional manifold. Regardless, it's the little k, you know, lowercase k extrinsic curvature. This is the definition for lowercase k AB, the extrinsic curvature of the two-dimensional surface embedded in the two-dimensional boundary of sigma t. And bottom line is what we find inside the boundary integral is simply little k, the trace of the two-dimensional extrinsic curvature. And at this stage, well, basically we're done. We're going to go back to our previous expression. We're going to replace all of this by little k. And we're going to replace this by a factor of the lapse function and then a two-dimensional volume element. And we're going to be integrating over time. So we're going to write it like that. And now we're done. That's the final expression for the action. (16π S). So the gravitational action is going to be expressed as an integral over time between sigma t1 and sigma t2. And inside the time integral, we're going to have a bulk term that involves a three-dimensional integral over each hypersurface sigma t. And that involves the three-dimensional quantities we have here. And we multiply this by the lapse, and we integrate over the three-dimensional volume. And then we have a boundary. And then we have a boundary term, which also comes with a surface integral. We have a factor of 2. And here it's an integral over the boundary ST of the hypersurface segment sigma t. And what we're integrating here is little k that multiplies n that multiplies square root of sigma. And we're doing a two-dimensional integration here. And that's the expression for the action that I wanted. That's the action expressed, as I said, in proper 3+1 form. And that's the form of the action that is now ready to go through the Hamiltonian procedure, where from it we define what is the time derivative of our field variables. And we go through the procedure of defining momentum and then obtaining a Hamiltonian density and then a Hamiltonian, you know, usually just following the procedure that I laid out this morning, you know, this time for gravity as opposed to some other field theory. All right. This expression for the action, I think, is pretty nice. I mean, given how, you know, it started out rather complex and you know, with lots of terms. But when the dust settles, you find something that's pretty nice and actually pretty with a nice interpretation in terms of, you know, a time integral, but then things that live purely on the hypersurface. So you have, you know, something that lives purely on the hypersurface here, the three-dimensional Ricci scalar, and then the extrinsic curvature, and then something on the boundary that has an immediate interpretation, you know, geometrical interpretation. What we have to involve on the boundary is nothing more than the, you know, two-dimensional extrinsic curvature of the boundary as embedded in that three-dimensional space-like surface. You know, it all comes out very nicely, I find. All right? No questions? Okay, so it's just a bunch of calculations that led us to that state. In the book I have, I do the calculation and then I say, oh, well, but all along we forgot about the K-naught term, in the original action that was supposed to renormalize the action so that it's zero for flat space time. And in fact, you can, go through the calculations and convince yourself that you can reinstate the K-naught at this level. You can, reinstate that non-dynamical term in the action that's only there to make sure that the action of flat space time is zero, and reinsert it here. So I'll do that at some point. I don't need it here, but at some point I'll do that. I'll just, reinsert a K-naught term right here. But here it's going to be a two-dimensional K-naught as opposed to a three-dimensional K-naught as I had it originally. So that's not a big deal, and it's essentially just another, it's the extra step that you need to do to make the numerical value of the action well-defined for asymptotically flat spacetimes. Okay, well, now we have the action in the right form. Now we can apply the Hamiltonian procedures, the whole set of recipes to get to the Hamiltonian, starting from the action. And, of course, we have a Lagrangian density involved here as well. And a twist on the story that I told you this morning is that, well, now we have a boundary term that we need to pay careful attention to. Okay, well, the first thing we're going to need to figure out is what is the time derivative of the metric, and where is it in the Lagrangian? Any ideas? Is there any hint that the Lagrangian has a time derivative of the metric in it? No one remembers the meaning of the extrinsic curvature? No one is responding on my hint. Everybody's asleep. So, who's going to be brave and tell me what the answer is? Yeah, Taylor? Right. Right, so we need to flesh this out a little bit. But the time derivative of the metric is actually buried in the extrinsic curvature, and that's what we're going to use. That's going to be our hook to define h dot and to then define a momentum associated with that. And here, we have to start paying attention to what our configuration variables are and what our canonical variables will end up being. We start out with a theory involving a space-time metric, right, g alpha beta. And we break down g alpha beta into an induced metric h, which is implicitly contained here, and a lapse and a shift. And then we have to decide whether all of those variables will have associated momenta, conjugate momenta, or whether some of the variables will turn out to be non-dynamical, that is, they won't possess any conjugate momenta associated with them. And the point I want to get to is the fact that, well, there will be there will be a conjugate momentum to H, the induced metric, but there won't be any canonical momenta associated with N, with the lapse and the shift. And that's not a choice that I make. It's something that comes out straight of the action. If you look for an N dot in the action, you won't find it. If you look for a time derivative of NA of the shift vector in the action, you won't find it. And therefore, the derivatives of the Lagrangian with respect to N dot or NA dot are identically zero, and that tells us that we don't have conjugate momenta to N to the last NORDA shift. And that's a very important aspect of the Hamiltonian formulation of GR, is the fact that the only field variables that we really have in our phase space are going to be the components of the induced metric and their associated momenta. The lapse and the shift are not part of the phase space variables. And that's sort of easy to understand. I mean, that's all part of the freedom of coordinate transformations. Specifying the lapse and the shift tells us how we flow from one hypersurface to another. It's not gravitational information. It's not something that really belongs in the phase space of general relativity. It's something that's merely there to specify the coordinate freedom, to characterize the coordinate freedom that we have still present in this formulation. So HAB will be, you know, will be the generalized coordinates of our Hamiltonian formulation. There's going to be a conjugate momentum to that. I'm going to call it PAB. But N and but the shift and the lapse are just going to come along for the ride. They're not going to be dynamical variables. They won't have associated momenta. And again, the reason is that it's not something that I just say should be true. It's something that comes from the fact that there's no sign of there being an N dot derivative, you know, in the Lagrangian, nor a time derivative of the shift. The only thing that appears that's time differentiated in the action is contained in the extrinsic curvature, and the only thing that we differentiate with respect to time here is the three-dimensional induced metric. So that's a very important lesson, and that's a rather deep fact about general relativity and its Hamiltonian description. Okay. So let's define a time derivative for the metric. And we're going to define it in the way that we were told to in the context of field theories before. We're going to define that to be the Lie derivative along the vector t, the flow vector t alpha, of, well, the induced metric on each hypersurface. So that's the definition of the time derivative. And said more fully, what we have is the Lie derivative of the space-time metric projected down to each hypersurface, and while in fact this turns out to be the Lie derivative of the metric projected down to the hypersurface. And the reason is that, well, each one of the tangent vectors turns out to be Lie transported along the flow vector. And that's a very simple property that simply follows from the fact that T alpha was defined as a partial derivative in the same way that the tangent vectors were defined as partial derivatives. And you know, the statement that second partial derivatives will commute is the statement that this vector is parallel, is Lie transported along that vector, or the other way around. So as a consequence of those definitions, we have the statement that each tangent vector is actually Lie transported along the flow vector. It's an immediate consequence. So what I have to do then to find what H dot is to evaluate the Lie derivative of the metric, and then I take a projection. And the Lie derivative of the metric, of course, can be re-expressed in terms of covariant derivatives of the flow vector. And that's what we got here. So I need to work on that. So let's remember that the flow vector is expressed in terms of the normal vector and the tangent vectors with components involving the lapse and the shift. If I take a derivative of this, well, I have to differentiate the normal vector. I also have to differentiate the lapse. And then I'll just write the rest of it as n alpha. So I'll just write this here as n alpha. And this also needs to be differentiated. So I have to consider all of that. But what I have to do is to take projections. So when I do this piece of it, this term will survive. And you already know what this will give me. That's the extrinsic curvature. This piece doesn't survive because this is a normal piece. And I'm taking a tangential projection of that. And the other thing that survives is the derivative of the lapse vector promoted as a space-time vector. This becomes the extrinsic curvature. And that, if you again go back to what we were doing when we were comparing, you know, connections on the hypersurface versus connections, the connection in space-time, this is actually the same thing as the intrinsic covariant derivative of the shift considered as a three vector and differentiated with a connection compatible with H. If you remember what we did, you know, a few weeks ago, or if you go back to that, what you'll remember is that, you know, there's no distinction between a projected space-time derivative and an intrinsic covariant derivative. They're exactly the same operations. So I'm just going to rewrite all of this in terms of a three-dimensional covariant derivative of the shift vector. And this is my notation for, you know, covariant derivative compatible with a connection that we get from the induced metric HAB. So, well, we got all that, so we can plug that back into here. And the extrinsic curvature term is symmetric, so I get 2n KAB. And then I get a term like this and another one with the symmetric combination. And this is what HAB stands for. HAB dot is all that. So before I was telling you that, well, it's, you know, it's loosely, while I told you I was forcing you to conclude that H dot is contained here through the extrinsic curvature. And of course, I was not wrong about this. I was not, you know, misleading you. Except that, well, the details are such that H dot AB is the extrinsic curvature up to a factor involving the lapse function and up to additional terms involving the shift. And essentially, all of that has to do with the fact that there's a distinction between the normal direction and the direction of the flow vector T. If we were choosing them to be the same, there would still be a, a factor of the lapse. But I would not have those extra terms. Those extra terms are there because I'm forcing the time derivative to be in a different direction from the normal derivative. Okay, so we have HAB, and now we know where HAB dot is going to be found within the Lagrangian density. It's going to be contained within the extrinsic curvature terms. So taking derivatives of the Lagrangian density with respect to HAB dot, which we need to do to get the canonical momenta, is going to be done by, you know, looking for, you know, for the occurrence of the extrinsic curvature and then, you know, incorporating that relationship between HAB dot and the extrinsic curvature. You have a question?
Why is the time derivative the lead derivative? Not like just the covariant derivative in the direction of time.
That's part of the rules that we formulated this morning. Okay. So it is the lead derivative, just because. Could it not be the covariant derivative? I think it makes no difference. And it makes no difference, well, yeah, I think it makes no difference because here, you know, I'm differentiating a bunch of scalar quantities when we view this from space-time. So the Lie derivative here is the same thing as an ordinary derivative in the direction of the vector T alpha. And so therefore, there's no distinction between Lie differentiation, covariant differentiation, and ordinary differentiation. It's just all the same thing. So why I chose to define it as a Lie derivative, I'm not quite sure. But, you know, given that there's no distinction between these things, this is probably the faster way to the results. Good question.
When we defined Q dot, we could have done the same thing because Q dot was a scalar.
Was a scalar. That's right. That's right. Yeah, so that was a good question. Okay, well, now, so we have H dot, you know, we can find the momenta associated with the three-dimensional metric. And what we remember is that, well, the canonical momenta are going to be defined by taking derivatives with respect to H dot of the Lagrangian density. And here we have to insert factors of root g. That's the definition for what canonical momenta are going to be in this context. So we're looking for all the H dots, and we know that all the H dots are buried in the three-dimensional extrinsic curvature, the uppercase KAB and its trace. Little k is not involved here. Little k is completely independent from capital K. Uppercase K is completely independent from lowercase k. K describes the embedding of ST within sigma T. It has no time derivative information in it. And what that tells us is that, well, only the bulk term actually involves H dot through K, AB. The boundary term does not involve H dot through anything. And therefore, when I'm going to take a partial derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to H dot, I don't have to worry about the boundary term. I only have to worry about the bulk term. And taking a derivative with respect to H dot of the bulk term, well, it's going to be something that I can do in two steps. I can first take a derivative with respect to KAB and then differentiate that with respect to H dot AB. So I'm going to do the calculation like that. All right. So, well, let's just rewrite this as an H dot derivative of the bulk part of the Lagrangian density. And then let's replace the H dot derivative by KAB derivatives. They're directly proportional. All of that stuff doesn't, you know, doesn't come in for the derivative operation because none of that, there's no sign, there's no appearance of the shift vector inside the bulk Lagrangian. So to differentiate with respect to H dot, it's sufficient to differentiate with respect to K. If there were factors involving the shift here, we'd have to be much more careful, but there are no factors of the shift vector entering inside the bulk Lagrangian. So, well, what I'm going to say is that, well, this is 1 over 2n, a derivative with respect to KAB of the bulk Lagrangian, which I'm going to write down explicitly. The bulk Lagrangian is what appears inside the integral. And we get a factor of n. We get a factor of root h. And we get everything else, which is 3r. Plus, here I have to be careful because I'm using AB as summation indices over there. I don't want to confuse them with my committed indices here. So I'll just write this as KCD, KCD minus K squared. And that's what I need to evaluate. I'll get rid of the factors of n. H is an independent variable from K. So that just comes out of the derivative operator. The scalar curvature depends only on H. It doesn't depend on K. So this, this doesn't do anything. So the only K dependence that I need to worry about here is contained in those two terms. So PAB, after what I just said, is, there's going to be a factor of 1/2 root H. We still take a derivative with respect to KAB. And what we differentiate, I'm going to write it in a slightly different form. I'm going to say that whatever we are differentiating is going to be quadratic in the extrinsic curvature. So I'm going to write it as KCD KEF. And I'm going to form those particular quadratic combinations by involving the induced metric in the appropriate way. So what I need to do here is to raise this E and make it into a C. So I need a CE, and I need a DF. And if I do that, I've raised EF and made them CD, and I get exactly that term. And what I need also to reproduce this is to have an HCD and an HEF. And each term here will produce a trace, and we'll have K squared. And the reason for doing this is because, well, now I have something which is straightforward to differentiate with respect to KAB. And all of the rest of the stuff has to do with raising the indices. And that's an operation that has to do with H, has nothing to do with K. And I can undo all of that after taking the derivative. So let's do the derivative. When I differentiate something like this, well, the rule is that, you know, K11 differentiated with respect to K22 is 0. But K11 differentiated with K11 is 1. So we have a bunch of independent variables here. And in order to get a non-zero result, C has to agree with A, and D has to agree with B. Right? So when we differentiate the first factor, we get DAC DBD, multiplying KEF, KEF. And then we leave the first factor alone, and we differentiate the second factor. And now E has to agree with A, and F has to agree with B. So that's what we get. Yep?
K is not a metrical tensor.
It is.
So K12 is related to K21. So you think the delta is not constant?
Yes, you're very perceptive. I think what I ought to have done here is to symmetrize those indices to take care of that. So let's do it. Yeah, because you're right. I mean, K12 differentiated with respect to K21 is also 1. It's not 0, right?
If we add the symmetrization, then we will have 1/2.
The symmetrization operation by convention includes the 1/2.
So you will get the K11 is 1/2, it's not 1/2.
No, because the symmetrized version of A11 is going to be A11 plus A11 divided by 1/2. So.
But the K12, how about the K12?
K12 plus K21 divided by 2. I think it's okay. Anyway, if you're in doubt, you could try to do this more carefully and more slowly and make sure that I'm not missing factors of 2, but I think I'm okay. Yeah. Another question?
Will that affect the result if forget about that set symmetry?
Potentially, but not here. And what's going to happen is that, well, because the other factors here have all the right symmetry properties, if I forgot to symmetrize here, it would have happened anyway, naturally, because of what I'm multiplying. So that's why I didn't think too much about this. But the point is still correct that to write down the the actual correct expression for the partial derivatives, you need to make sure that you do symmetrize properly, because otherwise you'll conclude wrongly that K12 differentiated with respect to K21 would be zero, which is not, you know, which is not true. Okay. Anyway, those are sort of small points, but they can be important sometimes. So you had a...
Is that a general rule that the derivative of a symmetric object will have to be symmetric?
So we're differentiating a tensor with respect to a tensor, and we just have to make sure that, you know, that this operation doesn't, you know, allows for all the symmetries that this tensor possesses. Otherwise, you would just do something a little bit nonsensical.
So one could do it. One could differentiate a tensor with respect to another tensor without the new tensor getting the symmetries of the old one.
True, yeah. That's right. So that's an operation that could happen,
yeah.
Which is not this particular operation, but yeah. Okay, so we got that. And now, well, we just need to work on this and unravel the mess that we got. So we get a half square root of h. And now what I'm going to do is to multiply all of those terms together. So I'll get four terms altogether. And let's see. So the first thing that happens, so I have all of those delta functions multiplying the h's here. So I turn this c into an a. And then I preserve the e. I turn this d into a b. And I preserve the f. And here I'm supposed to symmetrize over a and b. So let's keep that in mind. But I won't indicate it explicitly. And the reason why I don't have to indicate it explicitly is because symmetrizing with respect to a and b is like symmetrizing with respect to e and f. But we already have that here. So that's what I was saying before. That I could afford not to be careful with my symmetrization here because, you know, there's always going to be something multiplying that will, you know, take care of the symmetrization automatically. So again, so here we have the symmetrization over a and b. I should have it here, but symmetrization over a and b in this case is the same thing as symmetrization over e and f. Here we have something symmetric in e and f, so I don't need to indicate it explicitly. Anyway, someone can get really irritated by all of the fine print there. Okay, so we have that times this, and then we have that times that. And here we have, let's see, we have HAB, which is symmetric, multiplying the trace of K. And now I have those two terms. So in this case, we have KCD. And what I'm going to do here is to So I'm multiplying the delta functions here. So I'm changing this e into an a, and I'm changing this f into a b, and I got that. And here I get minus sign, I get trace k, and I get h, ef turning into a b. And I get that. And if you look at this carefully and you relabel the dummy indices, what you find is that, well, you have twice this, twice that, and the two terms, all of that combines, we're going to get rid of the square root. And the final conclusion is that PAB, the canonical momenta associated with H, are equal to a square root of H multiplying K AB, so here I'm raising the indices on K, minus HABK. So, except for traces and factors of root H, what we find is that the canonical momenta in the Hamiltonian formulation is just the extrinsic curvature. The canonical momentum variable is, you know, apart from this factor and apart from, you know, adding traces, is simply related to the extrinsic curvature. So the meaning of the extrinsic curvature in the Hamiltonian formulation is that, you know, apart from those little subtleties, the extrinsic curvature is the canonical, well, is essentially the canonical momentum conjugate to the metric. Yep?
Isn't that apart from the 1/2b three-dimensional Einstein tensor.
Sorry, say that again?
Apart from the 1/2 before the HAB, that is the three-dimensional Einstein tensor.
That's right. It's the extrinsic curvature, not the Ricci tensor, and then you would still be missing the factor of 1/2.
Yeah. Sorry.
So there's no real relation. Okay. So we had that Lagrangian right there. We recognized that this Lagrangian had an H dot in it, buried in the extrinsic curvature. So essentially, that's the expression that tells us that the extrinsic curvature, apart from this stuff over here, is simply a stand-in for H dot. And then from the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to H dot, we form the momenta. And then if we were tempted to go and find additional canonical variables, well, we wouldn't find any, because as I said before, the lapse n does not have an n dot in the Lagrangian. And the shift Na does not have a derivative in the Lagrangian. And therefore, so because we don't have that, there are no canonical momenta associated with those variables. So that the entire phase space here is going to be the phase space of H and P and nothing else. The lapse and the shift are not there as dynamical variables. The lapse and the shift are there purely in terms of telling us how we flow from one hypersurface to another. So I said something about that before. It's, as I said, an important aspect of general relativity. OK. Well, now we're ready for the last step, which is to build a Hamiltonian. So now we follow the PQ dot procedure, PQ dot minus L procedure, and we build the Hamiltonian, and then we'll see what we get. And I think we can manage that in about half an hour. The boundary term is still there, right? So the boundary term will need to be, will need to appear in the Hamiltonian, but it's just going to come along for the ride. When I do PQ dot minus L, the boundary term will come in the minus L piece, but a PQ dot is going to involve only the bulk part of the Hamiltonian, which will then become the bulk part of the Hamiltonian, of the Lagrangian that becomes the bulk part of the Hamiltonian. So I won't worry too much about the bulk, about the boundary term for a little while, but in the end I'm going to bring it back because it has to be there as part of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so let's construct the Hamiltonian density, focusing for the time being on just the bulk part. So I'll write this as 16 pi curly H bulk that we're going to be defining as 16 pi PAB H dot AB minus 16 pi L bulk root G. The 16 pi's are really irritating. And if you read the original literature on the Hamiltonian formulation by ADM, Arnewit, Deser, and Misner, they wisely chose their gravitational constant not to equal 1, but to equal 16 pi. And they were very wise to do that, because they're just a pain to carry all over the place all the time. All right, so that's the prescription. 16 pi PAB, we have it over there. I was missing the 16 pi over here. See what I mean? Very irritating. I was missing the 16 pi over here because when I wrote down that expression for the bulk Lagrangian, it was missing a factor of 16 pi that you can see over there on the left-hand side of the equation. So I was missing it. Here. On which side? Oh, yes. So what I really wanted to do is to put it here, so I can put it here and then carry it all over the place. G is 16 pi. Yeah?
Given that the physics that results from the Lagrangian doesn't depend on an overall multiplicative factor, couldn't you have just left the 16 pi to emerge later when you put in the team in the loop?
Yeah. That would have been better, I think. Except that, you know, yeah, you could redefine the matter Lagrangian to include the 16 pi. That would be just good enough. But then from just the purely matter action, it would look strange. So that's why people inserted there in the gravitational action. But anyway, we could work in units where 16 pi is equal to 1, right? Right. Well, yeah. OK. Enough. OK. 16 pi PAB is root h, multiplying the extrinsic curvature minus HAB times the square, times the trace. And then we multiply this by h dot, which is right over here. So we have 2n KAB minus derivative of shift. And we remove the bulk Lagrangian, the Lagrangian density, which means that we're removing, so all of that multiplies n. We have 3n plus KAB, KAB minus k squared. And all that also multiplies root h. OK. Let's see. So I'll gather together everything that comes with a shift. And so we're going to have 2 KAB, KAB coming from this multiplication. And we're going to have minus 2 HAB multiplying KAB gives us a K. And we already have one over here. So we have minus K squared. And from the second line, we remove the three-dimensional Ricci scalar, and then KAB, KAB, plus K squared. So all those terms will consolidate and simplify. And then to that, we add the terms that depend on the shift. And we get minus square root H KAB minus HAB. And what I'll do here is to notice that here we're multiplying something symmetric to something symmetric. And we might as well just rewrite this without bothering to symmetrize this piece over here. And that's the extra factor of 2 that we pick up when we do that. So here I don't have to symmetrize this derivative. The symmetrization is implicitly carried out by multiplying that by something which is obviously symmetric. And I forgot the k here.
What is
Sorry, where?
Second line?
Yeah?
Oh, right.
These ones.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yep, positive. OK. So let's simplify this a little bit. OK, for the first term, for the first line, we get something that now starts to look really simple. We have KAB, KAB minus K squared minus 3R. And then for the second line, what I'm going to do is to distribute the derivatives for a reason that will become clear in a second or two. I'm going to leave the factor of 2 and leave the factor of root h alone. But what I'm going to do is to differentiate everything else first with respect to dA. so that I can put that into the boundary in just a second. And then, of course, I have to compensate for this. And what I need to do is to leave the NB alone and then differentiate the extensic curvatures. And now we're really getting close. Let's integrate this over the hypersurface to get the full Hamiltonian. The full Hamiltonian is what I get by integrating this, but that's only the bulk part of the Hamiltonian. On top of that, I also have to include the stuff that will come from the boundary of the Lagrangian, and that will come with an extra minus sign because it's PQ dot minus L that appears in the Lagrangian. So let's do all of that. We're integrating over sigma t, and I'm going to keep those two terms, of course, inside the integral of sigma t. And in each case, I'm going to have a root h coming in. And what's left over is the lapse multiplying multiplying all of that. And I have a term involving the shift, which is the last term over here. And that comes with a minus 2, a factor of nb, and a derivative of KAB minus HABK. And all of that is integrated over sigma t hypersurface. And next to that, I'm going to pick up two boundary terms, one coming from over there that came along for the ride, and one coming by pushing this term to the boundary by using the three-dimensional version of Gauss's theorem. So the next two terms are going to be boundary integrals, and there's going to be a common factor of 2 for each that I'm going to put inside. The first term comes from over there, so it comes with an extra minus sign, so we get nk times the volume element, which I'm going to leave out for the time being. And then we get everything else coming from here, which involves, coming from here. And after using Gauss's theorem, I get KAB minus HABK. That multiplies NB and multiplies also the surface element on ST. And, well, long story short, the surface element can be written in terms of the normal vector RA, our good old friend. And then the rest of it is simply the ordinary two-dimensional volume element on sigma t. And I was missing a curly bracket over here. So let me rewrite this in a neater form, because for the next... This is the final expression for the Hamiltonian. No more work is required. But I'll just rewrite it to make it a little bit prettier. So the Hamiltonian involves a three-dimensional surface term. And inside that, we have a lapse, and we have the square of the extrinsic curvature, minus k squared minus 3r. And also, we have the lapse function, the shift vector, that multiplies the covariant derivative of the extrinsic curvature. And all of that we integrate over the volume element on the hypersurface. And then we have a boundary term. Which involves minus the lapse times the extrinsic curvature. And here I'll reinstate the K0 term for reasons that I explained before and for reasons that I'll probably say a bit more about. So that's just what should have been there all along if I had just incorporated the uppercase K0 into the definition of the gravitational Lagrangian to begin with and just carried that along for the whole duration. So it appears now in this place. And then what we have here is also is the shift vector multiplying KAB minus HABK, multiplying the normal vector to ST. And this we integrate over the two-dimensional surface element. So that, finally, is the gravitational Hamiltonian. And let's see, do I agree with myself? I seem to. Very good. Okay, so what do we do with a gravitational Hamiltonian? Well, one thing we could do is to, derive the Hamilton form of Einstein's equations. So what we would do, presumably, here I haven't talked about the matter Hamiltonian. So presumably, if we wanted to have a complete description with matter, what we would have had to do is to, go back to the matter Lagrangian and, decompose that in 3 plus 1 and come up with a Hamiltonian for that. We would have added the Hamiltonians, and that would have been our complete Hamiltonian for everything in the theory. And if we, and then we could have followed the procedure where you re-express the gravitational action in terms of the Hamiltonian in the usual PQ dot minus H, combination. And then you vary the action, keeping all the phase space variables independent. You go through all of that recipe. And I do that in the book, and it takes about 325 pages. It's a horrible long calculation. And what you would end up with is Einstein's equations written in Hamilton form, where you have one equation telling you what HB is doing, what its derivative with respect to time is doing, and another equation that tells you what the other, what the canonical momentum is doing, or, its stand-in KAB. And that would be a different writing of the Einstein field equations that, really relies on the 3 plus 1 decomposition. An evolution equation for H, an evolution equation for K. Of course, you don't have evolution equations for N and NA because this is not part of the phase space. That is, very useful because when you have equations written in that form, that's usually the starting point for attempting a numerical integration. When people in numerical relativity try to integrate the Einstein field equations, they do much more than this, but the starting point is an ADM type decomposition, a 3 plus 1 decomposition, where you have evolution equations for in first order form expressed in terms of the canonical variables or something closely related to that. Well, I won't go through that. I mean, there are just too many calculations involved. In the good old days, I was cruel and I would assign students as a homework problem the task of going through that themselves. But anyway, let's not worry too much about that. What I want to point out, though, is an interesting feature of the Hamiltonian. Suppose that you take the gravitational Hamiltonian and you say, I'm going to calculate the numerical value of the Hamiltonian for a solution to the Einstein field equations. What would you get? No, not zero. Because of the boundary terms, it's not zero. But it's almost zero. Okay, here we don't have a matter term, so let's do gravity in vacuum. Gravity in vacuum, if we evaluate the Hamiltonian for a vacuum solution to the Einstein field equations, we find that this term is zero because this is the constraint equation. This is one of the two constraint equations that tells us something about the Ricci curvature and the extrinsic curvature on any slice of our space-time, any slice sigma t of our space-time. So by virtue of the constraint equations, this term in the bulk Hamiltonian vanishes. This is also zero by the constraint equations. The constraint equations the constraints in vacuum, if you go back to your notes, tell us precisely that the Ricci curvature plus KAB, KAB minus K squared is equal to zero. And they also tell us that the covariant derivative of the extrinsic curvature minus its trace is zero. Those are, you know, 1 and 3/4 of the Einstein field equations that represent constraint equations instead of evolution equations. So if you evaluate the Hamiltonian for solution, this goes away, and what you find is that the only contribution that the Hamiltonian gets comes from the boundary terms. And the gravitational Hamiltonian is not zero because of the boundary terms. If you generalize the situation and look at a non-vacuum situation, and if you insert, for example, a scalar field into your space-time and use that as a description of matter, what would happen is that, well, the full Hamiltonian, the complete Hamiltonian, you know, gravity plus matter, would acquire additional bulk terms that would make up the, that would, in fact, you know, outside of vacuum with matter, you would find that this has to be equal to the matter density on the hypersurface, and this has to be equal to, well, something like the normal tangential component to the energy momentum tensor. The indices are wrong, but anyway. The point is that if you inserted a matter term into the Hamiltonian, you would modify the bulk term, but you would not modify the conclusion that it's zero for a solution, because now the constraint equations would be modified to account for the non-zero right-hand sides, regardless the boundary terms for a matter model, for a complete Hamiltonian with gravity and matter in it would still be a zero bulk term. And the only contribution to the full Hamiltonian would come from the boundary terms. So that's a firm conclusion. That's a very robust conclusion. There are some exceptions to that. If you do Yang-Mills theory, for example, there are situations where bulk, you know, where surface terms appear also in that context, which means that it's possible also to modify the boundary terms, but let's not worry too much about that. The bottom line for my purposes here is this. Whenever you take the gravitational Hamiltonian and you evaluate it for a solution to the Einstein field equations, the bulk term is zero. The bulk term is pure constraint. The bulk term is zero for a solution. The Hamiltonian picks up a numerical value purely by virtue of having a boundary term. In the old days, no one worried about the boundary term. The boundary term was, you know, partly there at the back of your mind, but it was not part of a systematic development of the Lagrangian formulation and then the Hamiltonian formulation. And in the old days, for example, you read MTW, and it's not, you know, uncommon to read that the Hamiltonian is zero. The Hamiltonian of gravity is always zero. But that's not quite right. I mean, it's not right, and in fact, it's not right in a rather powerful and interesting way, because those boundary terms turn out actually to bring out all sorts of very nice, juicy physical information. By the way, if you're dealing with a manifold without a boundary, if you do all of this, for example, in a closed universe, well, you could make the entire domain the entire universe, and there would be no boundary. And in this case, all the boundary terms would be completely irrelevant. And in those situations, you don't have boundary terms. You don't need them. They're not there. And that's the statement that the energy of a closed universe has got to be zero. That's the value you get, you know, automatically from working out the Hamiltonian. But if you have a space-time with a boundary, or if you have a space-time that is asymptotically flat, then the boundary terms are actually very important, and they bring out all sorts of useful information. And that's, you know, I'll discuss this much more fully next time, but it's very nice what comes out of all this. Let me say just a few more things, and I'll give you a hint for what's going to come next week. There's a lot that goes into this construction, and you know, I talked about that a little bit this morning. You know, the starting point is the foliation of space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. So you need to do that first. You need to specify a foliation before you even get started. Once you have the foliation and, you know, you adopt it once and for all, you still have the freedom of how you flow in the foliation. That's the freedom associated with the choice of lapse and shift, or the freedom associated with the choice of flow vector T alpha. When you evaluate the Hamiltonian for a solution, regardless of the choice you make for N and NB, you get zero for the bulk term. But the numerical value of the boundary terms will depend, will care about what you pick for N and what you pick for NA. And what that tells you is that you get different Hamiltonians, different numerical values for the Hamiltonian, depending on what you choose for N, depending on what you choose for the shift vector. The Hamiltonian for a solution becomes a functional of a choice you make for the lapse and the shift. Well, what does that mean? Well, I'm not sure that I know what it means, but I can look at some examples that you know, bring out something pretty pretty neat. Suppose that having selected my foliation, I choose to set the lapse to zero, the shift to zero, and I choose to set the lapse to some, you know, value. Well, in terms of the flow vector, that means that now I'm moving normally to the hypersurfaces. That's the choice that I make. In other words, what I'm describing here when I choose the shift to be zero and the lapse to be non-zero is something like a time translation. Well, next week I'm going to make this a bit more precise. I'm going to talk about hypersurfaces, a foliation that goes back into that you know, asymptotes to surfaces of constant time in the asymptotically flat portion of the spacetime. So at infinity, very far away, I want to think of my foliation as being as doing the same thing as a foliation of Minkowski spacetime in surfaces of constant time. In that context, I'm going to pick N to be a vector that is normal to surfaces of constant time. And my flow vector is going to be normal to those surfaces. And N is going to be 1. I'm going to choose the lapse to be 1. And the flow vector that I pick, or this choice of lapse and shift, will describe an asymptotic time translation. I make this choice. I evaluate the Hamiltonian. What do I get? The mass of the spacetime. So what is the mass of the spacetime? The mass of the spacetime is the gravitational Hamiltonian associated with a specific choice of lapse and shift, one that corresponds to asymptotic time translations. And we have a direct connection between time translations and mass. And the connection is brought by the Hamiltonian. Let me say something more. What if I do something else? What if I choose a different lapse and shift? What if I set the lapse to zero and I decide to flow within the hypersurface and I let the flow vector describe a rotation? That would be a choice where N is zero and this vector points, for example, around an axis. It describes a rotation around some axis. For this choice, I calculate the Hamiltonian. I get the angular momentum of the spacetime. And now we have a connection between angular momentum and asymptotic rotations. The connection is brought by the Hamiltonian. Well, you can do more. You can do additional things. For example, instead of going around, you could move in one direction. You could do asymptotic translations in space. And if you calculate the Hamiltonian in that case, well, you're going to get something that looks like linear momentum. So what the Hamiltonian does, and I find that extremely beautiful here, is that, well, you pick a foliation that does the right thing at infinity, you look at all, you know, the sort of the simpler choice, you know, the simple choices you can make for a flow vector or for the lapse and the shift, and you bring a connection, you reveal a connection between the gravitational Hamiltonian and things that describe the space-time, characterize the space-time from a large distance away. Things like conserved quantities, you know, global charges like mass, angular momentum, linear momentum, all of those quantities derive from the Hamiltonian, and they all come from a unified point of view where all you do is to tweak your choice for these two things, and all of those, you know, beautiful quantities, conserved quantities, global charges for the space-time all appear, all come out as different aspects of the Hamiltonian. So in a sense, the Hamiltonian is a sort of packaging of all those beautiful conserved global charges associated with the space-time. They're all contained in the Hamiltonian, and you just go and pluck them out by choosing appropriate things for the lapse and the shift. And if you want the mass, you go for time translations. If you want the angular momentum, you go for asymptotic rotations. If you want the linear momentum, you go for asymptotic translations. All of that is contained in the Hamiltonian. So, well, I'll go through the details of that next time, but I think the ideas are absolutely beautiful. And it's something that was not appreciated until fairly recently when people, you know, and I'm talking here about the 70s, when people started to look at the boundary terms more seriously, and they saw that all of that was there, and all you had to do is to go and, you know, pluck it out, and it was all there waiting for you. All you had to do is to go through this this procedure of forming the Hamiltonian. So, Harvey, you had a question?
Well, if you'd started the whole procedure using the gamma-gamma Lagrange, would you likewise pick up this boundary term?
I don't know. I don't know. That's an interesting question. My suspicion is that with the gamma-gamma action, you don't need boundary terms because the action is already first order.
But
the end result would have been something that, so the resulting Hamiltonian would be something that in the first run through the problem would involve only a bulk term, but something highly non-tensorial that you would have to work on very heavily to make it tensorial, and it would become tensorial presumably up to a divergence that you would then push to the boundary, and perhaps you would fall back on your feet and derive an expression that looks identical to that. I don't know. But, you know, that's something that could be investigated. You just go through it and see what you get, but it's probably not easy. Probably not very easy to go through the calculations, but it's probably doable.
But if you had, what you're saying is that under certain circumstances, I mean, particular conditions of infinity, certain coordinate systems will be naturally adapted. So that, in other words, you will fix your lapse and your shift in a very special way that make the Hamiltonian have these properties of representing angular momentum or mass.
Right.
But there would be, in the Lagrangian formulas, there would be something corresponding to that. You'd have a Noether type. Wouldn't you have a Noether type symmetries of some sort? I'm not quite sure how, but.
Right. So if it's in the Hamiltonian, it must be also in the Lagrangian. How to bring it out of the Lagrangian into the open, I don't know exactly how you would go about this, but of course, I mean, you're not, you know, inventing new things here. It's all, you know, if it was there at the beginning, it's there in the end. You haven't produced, you know, you don't have spontaneous creation of knowledge as you go through all of this. But I think the point is that this makes the extraction particularly convenient and easy. Whereas if you tried to do it differently, you would have to work harder. It's not so much an issue of choosing a coordinate system. It's really an issue of making sure that you have a foliation that's compatible with asymptotic flatness, and then choosing how you want to flow across the foliation. And I view that either as a choice of flow vector T alpha or as a choice of lapse and shift. it's equivalent. But if you choose the flow vector, of course, you don't have that same. So choosing this and this seems to, you know, say something about choosing coordinate systems. But choosing the flow vector, you know, removes that sort of temptation. So so it's really a matter of choosing how to flow in the given foliation. Other questions? OK, so let's pick this up from here next week.